We are talking about the five operas in this season of the Santa Fe Opera, and we're talking today to Desiree Mays, International Opera Lecturer and Storyteller. International Opera Lecturer and Storyteller, and author of the new book Opera Unveiled, now in its 15th year. She speaks every night at the Preview Buffet at the Opera. Welcome, Desiree, to the Radio Cafe.
Hello, Mary Charlotte. It's good to be here.
We're talking today about the opera La Donna del Lago, The Lady of the Lake, by Gioachino Rossini. And this also is a fun and, I suppose, not too tragic opera.
No, nobody dies at the end. Well, one man dies. The leading lady has three suitors in this opera, and you know, you have to do something with three of them.
That's true. It's a love quadrilateral.
Yes, absolutely. And they're all very different. We're going to play some music from each one so you get to the sound of the different voices. But it is Rossini, and so the music, by definition, is going to be melodic and quite gorgeous. It really is. So this opera is a real treat. It's not a comedy. It's a sort of a straight story. It's based on Sir Walter Scott's famous poem, The Lady of the Lake, which is all set, of course, in his native Scotland. That's where he loved to write all his pieces. So you hear about the glens, the hills, the dales, the craggy moorish hilltop, not hilltops, but the open spaces, the wastelands of Scotland, which is where the opera's set.
In Italian, of course.
In Italian, of course, yes. But that's okay.
So it's interesting that in so many of the operas that are written by composers, say, of Italy, it has actually Celtic origins. Mm. And, I mean, they use the names of the people, Roderick and Malcolm and so on.
Yes, both Celtic and Scottish, of course. This, and it really is a story about the Celts who were sort of moved up the country of England to the north and into Scotland and into Ireland. You tend to think mainly of Ireland as being as the Celtic country, but actually there are Celts all over Scotland as well. And the way that history developed, I mean, we're talking about the 1500s here, in the time of James V, the King of Scotland. But Scotland was a pretty unruly, wild place at the time. The Highland chieftains were the local kings and lords and the people to whom allegiance was paid, not to the king so much. So there's a lot of infighting, and that's really what this is sort of a sub dialogue about the what's going on amongst these fighting clans in the opera, because the leading lady, the Lady of the Lake, Elena, or Ellen as she was in the poem, is the daughter of a Highland chieftain who's been exiled. Their protector is Roderick, who loves her, of course, and the head of another clan who is a mezzo-soprano. That's always thrown into a Rossini opera, that one of the three suitors is not a man at all. It's a mezzo-soprano. And then the third is the mysterious king, but we'll get to that when we get into the story.
Why did they do that? I mean, the man that Ellen is in love with is actually sung by a woman.
Mm.
Are there lesbian subtexts here? What's going on?
No.
Seriously.
Not in those days, no. Not at all.
But there was just as much lesbianism then, is there?
Yes,
there?
I'm sure there was. But it wasn't something these male composers wrote into their operas, actually. I think mainly it was a tradition that sort of evolved. It's done mainly for the sound of the voice. For people who may have seen the Julius Caesar in the spring on the HD Met screening, there were a number, the most beautiful duets in that opera were between the soprano and the mezzo-soprano, who happened to be a mother and son. So the mezzo singing the son role. But when you heard those two women sing together, it was a hair-raisingly beautiful experience for the sound of the voices. That was what happened. And then there's all the gender issue that comes up that goes all the way back to the beginning, where there were castrati who were then replaced by mezzos or by altos. Women took over the castrati roles. So that was what happened. And then with Mozart, for instance, when he has a character like Cherubino, a young teenager probably in love with love, to get a sense of that extreme youth, they used female singers. And this actually went on right up to the time of Richard Strauss and the 20th century. You have very often a female singer. In the very beginning, for instance, going back all the way to Orfeo, it were two women who sang the leading roles, or maybe even a castrato then. So it's been a sort of part of the evolution of opera that mezzo-sopranos, women, will sing what we call pants roles. roles. And that's still true with Rossini. It dies out by the time of Verdi and Puccini. You rarely get it then. Though, as I say, there was a recurrence with Richard Strauss. So it's a stylistic thing, I suppose, not a sensual, sexual connection there.
Although you can read it that way if you feel like it.
Oh, yes, and I've heard two leading sopranos say, you know, that we spend most of our time these days kissing one another because that's what's going on in those particular operas. But it is a male role, and this is a Scottish Highland chieftain, even though he may wear pants and not a kilt. Already you have a nice little twist there. And it turns out that of the three men, the one that she loves is Malcolm, who is the mezzo-soprano.
So let's tell the story.
Yes, let's get to the beginning of this. It starts, this beautiful opera, exactly where Sir Walter Scott starts. Sir Walter Scott wrote a long poem, and most of the libretto is very close to the original poem, which is not always the case with opera. Usually they take the story and then you chop and change. In this case, it's very close. So the very opening scene is very romantic. It's set in the highlands of Scotland by the side of a lake called Loch Katrine. And in the middle of this lake, there's a little island. And Douglas of Angus has been exiled there with his family. He lives not in hiding, but really in exile. And it turns out if you go to Scotland today, this little island in the middle of this lake is called Ellen's Isle. You can go visit. Anyway, this is the little island, the beautiful setting of Scotland and the Highlands. And there's a man who has been out hunting with his friends. This turns out actually to be James V, the king. But through most of the opera, he's in disguise. The real James V apparently was known for wandering in disguise amongst his people to find out what their concerns were, which is, I think, a sweet touch that he would do this. So often he was in disguise, he had another name, and at the beginning of the opera, he's been out hunting with his friends, he's got separated from them, and he's calling himself Uberto. So he blows his horn, his hunting horn, to try and contact them. And at the same moment as he's alone by the side of this lake, a tiny boat sails across the lake with a little single sail, and it's guided by a woman, and a woman who sings, and Uberto is convinced he's having some sort of a vision of some sort of a beautiful woman or an angel, and he falls instantly in love, and of course she sings. So the first aria we should play is this extraordinarily beautiful opening, which we will do at the Santa Fe Opera. It's not very often you have a sailboat sailing across our high desert, but we will. and Ellen will come on and sings O Matutini Albori. It's a song to the dawn. She thinks that she's heard the horns and that either her father is returning or her lover Malcolm is coming back. And let's hear a little of that lovely, lovely opening aria.
Opening aria from The Lady of the Lake, La Donna del Lago. And who is singing that role in Santa Fe this summer?
Well, we are all really excited with the soprano who is coming to – she's not a soprano. She's a mezzo, Joyce DiDonato. Joyce hails from Kansas City. She has made a major career for herself as a Rossini mezzo-soprano. Rossini wrote most of his leading roles for mezzo-sopranos rather than sopranos, which is unusual. And the reason was that he fell in love with the leading soprano of his day – and married her. So everything was written for her, and it's a mezzo voice. But in this opera, so we have then two mezzo sopranos, one who sings on the higher range, and that's Joyce, and then Malcolm the suitor, who's in the lower range. So when they sing together, again, you'll hear this lovely blending of the two. But Joyce is very special. She's a wonderful human being. She's very generous. And for instance, of this first aria, she said how kind it was of Rossini to give his leading lady this particular aria, which is a wonderful warm-up for the voice. She sings throughout the whole piece. Joyce believes this is an opera that shows how a woman's influence can bring about peace, I suppose. She strives for peace amongst all these warring chieftains from beginning to end. So she's been here before. She loves coming here. And she was last seen and will be seen as Cinderella for the Metz production. She sings there a lot now. So we are very fortunate to have her.
Rossini operas take a certain kind of virtuosity.
They do. Bel canto is the style. It's called beautiful singing. And it was a pretty structured style in his early days where you would have, you know, you'd have an aria and then a recitative, a little conversational bit, and another aria, not very many ensembles or chorus pieces. And the voice had to be very special. It had to have, first and foremost, that very beautiful sound with incredible flexibility and be able to flow over these sections where the singer could very often choose what they wanted to sing. These cadenzas in the part of the aria they would be able to choose. And to this day, very often a singer will get together with a conductor and decide how best to do that. Sometimes that was a little strange, because if a soprano, say, had a favorite section that she loved to sing, she'd literally take it with her to every opera and stick it into every opera, regardless of whether the opera was a comedy or a tragedy. You just get this incredible sound. And I'm going to play you that at the very end of this show with Joyce DiDonato singing, and you'll get a real sense of what bel canto really is, the way she sings it, with those lovely trills and ornamentations and going away from the simple line to show off the singer's voice and to show how beautiful the singing can be. So that's very typical for a Rossini opera, though in this particular piece, he doesn't do what we call the da capo aria, or the aria with many repeats. You sing a few lines and then repeat it and ornament and repeat and repeat. This is much more, it's not quite through composed, but the dialogue, the recitative will flow into a song, which will not be repeated many times. So it keeps the story moving.
Yeah.
It makes it much more accessible dramatically, and to stage it must be much easier, because it's a real challenge where you get four lines that are sung 10 times over by one singer standing alone on stage.
Yeah, then it's not even really a play anymore. It's just a kind of concert.
That's right. That's the whole suspension of belief that you have to constantly do in opera. Though today, I think, and from Verdi on, certainly with Puccini, these are very realistic stories that have to have dramatic pacing. With these earlier operas, no, they would just stand and sing. And they wouldn't always sing about the situation they were in the opera. They'd sing about what they were feeling. And so you get an expression of emotion in these arias. And that's true, again, of this last aria I'll play today that's so beautiful. But I thought now we might go through the three suitors for Ellen,
yes,
if you like. The first one is Roderick in the poem and Rodrigo in the opera, of course. And I'd like to play two little cuts here side by side. First of all, to give you a sense of what the warlike chieftain is about as he rallies his troops. You'll hear that. And then with a little brief break, he suddenly has a change of heart because he's in love with Elena. And he wonders why she hasn't come to meet him. And he sings of his love for her. And you would hardly believe it's the same singer, from this warlord to this suitor who's in love. Let's hear some of that now. This is suitor number one that we meet. He's not the first one, but he's the warlike one in the opera.
Eccomi a voi, miei prodi.
We've been listening to Rodrigo first in his warlike mode and then in his romantic mode. I have to say, Desiree, the warlike mode wasn't really that rough.
No, it isn't. Rossini's always beautiful. I mean, even if he's doing rallying cries, it's still very beautiful music. The recording, I should say, that we're using today is an Italian one with Katia Ricciarelli singing Elena, and we just heard Dano Raffanti singing Rodrigo. Samuel Rainey's on this recording, and the next one, suitor, is the mezzo-soprano Malcolm, sung by Lucia Valentini Terrani on this production. When he has been away fighting wars, he is in love with Ellen and she with him. And now he comes back after a while and he wonders if she is still in love with him. So there's a little angst in her aria when he first appears in this very beautiful, again, the opening one. This is again going back to the early style where the stage has been cleared, the singer comes on, sings his aria about how he's feeling. It's about, does she still love me? That's what the essence of this little brief cut is.
We're talking about the opera, The Lady of the Lake, La Donna del Lago, and that is The Man Who Loves Ellen.
Yes, it is. It's Malcolm Graham. Now, the third one is Uberto, who is the King of Scotland, and we don't know. She doesn't find out about this till the very end. When she sails,
she doesn't find out that he's king because he's undercover.
Until the end, that's right. He's Uberto as far as she's concerned. So she sails across the lake, and she moors her little boat, and she asks him who he is, and he says, I'm a lost hunter. I'm Uberto. And given the hospitality of the Highlands and that he's on his own, she invites him back to her island to stay overnight, and he's already falling for her. They get to the little island, and he sees in the humble abode the signs and the armor of some important chieftain, and he realizes that she is the daughter of Douglas of Angus. So he is really at risk here, being in this house in disguise. But he's fallen for her, and he sings of his attraction for her, and they sing this lovely duet at total cross purposes. He asks her, does she love someone else? And she says, yes, that she does love, and he thinks it's himself. She's thinking about Malcolm. He's thinking about her. So they're singing a love duet, but at total cross purposes, because they're not singing about one another. And because it's opera, you can do that. And the audience gets that quite well. So let's listen to Uberto, and then with Eleanor as she joins him.
Con te no,
So we have now met the four characters in the love quadrilateral.
That's right. There's a new term.
Three guys and a gal.
Absolutely. And given the choice, I would probably go for the last one with that beautiful sound.
Of I
the
know.
We'll have Lawrence Brownlee singing our Uberto, again, a renowned Rossinian tenor. So they have sung together many times, he and Joyce DiDonato. So that promises. That is wonderful.
We're talking to Desiree Mays about The Lady of the Lake, La Donna del Lago. It's part of the annual opera series of the Santa Fe Opera. We're going to take a break. We'll be back in just a moment. Please stay tuned to the Radio Cafe. And we're back with Desiree Mays, author of Opera Unveiled, talking about La Donna del Lago, The Lady of the Lake. And I have to say, this beautiful book, Opera Unveiled, you have one of the operas every year of an image from that is the cover store, is the cover of the book, the cover picture of the book. And this year it's La Donna del Lago, and there's a beautiful woman in a boat in a lake.
Yes, that was a real find, because every year we always have this this big challenge, how to find a perfect image to fit with one of the operas. And now I'm working with the Santa Fe Opera Company, the Opera Shop. They are actually producing the book, which is really nice, because I'm very bad at bookkeeping. None of them, they do a great job on that, and they have the book there. They sell it online, and it's out there. So between us, we came up with this particular picture. It's called The Lady of Shalott, which is not exactly the lady of our lake. So the painting is by John William Waterhouse. It was painted in 1888, so very romantic. And maybe I could tell you what the little sign, the caption says on the Tate Gallery wall next to the piece, because it's relevant. Tennyson's poem, The Lady of Shalott, published in 1883, tells of a woman suffering under a curse and living isolated in a tower near King Arthur's castle. So this opera goes back to Arthurian legend. This is the root. She is allowed to see the outside world only through its reflection in a mirror. One day she catches glimpse of the handsome knight Lancelot reflected and cannot resist looking at him directly. The punishment that follows results in her drifting in her boat downstream to Camelot, singing her last song, but dying before she reaches there. Waterhouse shows her letting go of the boat's chains while staring at a crucifix placed in front of three glittering candles. So it's a very beautiful image. Luckily, it does not say the Lady of Shalott on the prow of the boat, or I couldn't have used it. But it fits perfectly. There's one other nice little anecdote about this cover, Mary Shalott, that may be amusing. When I found this painting, we said, well, this is the one we want to use. Very romantic, very classical, of the lady on the lake in her boat. So I thought I'd call the production director, Paul Horpadel, to make quite sure that Our Lady of the Lake would not be coming on stage on jet skis. Because given the way operas are interpreted these days, everything is updated. I didn't know no idea how she was going to come on stage, but he assured me, yes, she's coming on a little sailboat. So I was able to use this painting for the cover, and it's really quite captivating. It works very well. I'm really pleased with it. So yeah, the books are out there. It's the 15th year now for this book, which is sort of amazing, and it's the five operas of the season. And I focus mainly on the operas rather than the production, because when I write the book, I'm not sure quite how the production. It's too early to know about production, so it's sort of about the pieces themselves and the background. Is one of the great joys for me in researching all opera is the new worlds it takes me into, all kinds of worlds: history, geography, psychology, a lot, philosophy, and there's very different worlds that I have to investigate. And going back to the Arthurian legends and Celtic stories is right up my street. So that was great.
Being the Irish gal that you
Absolutely,
are.
Absolutely, yes.
So let's see. How far have we gotten in the story?
Okay, there's one more person to meet, Douglas of Angus, who is the father, when his daughter Ellen tells him that she doesn't really want to get engaged to anyone at this point because she's secretly in love with Malcolm, and her father wants her to marry Rodrigo, of course, because he is their protector, and this would be a natural alliance. And in those days, fathers told their daughters whom to marry. But she stands up for her rights. She says, no, this is no time. We're going to war with the king, and I'm not going to make any decisions. So he's a bit angry at her. And in this little cut here that's actually sung by the great Samuel Ramey, Douglas of Angus, the father who is a bass, is telling her off. You'll have to do as you're told and marry the man that I choose for you.
Mostrami te la figlia degna del genitor. Mostrami te la figlia degna del genitor. Degna del genitor. Passaggero orgoglio, perdono i dell'incesto, mi dico a questo ampesso che mi sei cara ancor, mi dico a questo ampesso che mi sei cara ancor, mi dico a questo ampesso.
And we're listening to music of La Donna del Lago, the Lady of the Lake, and that was Father the Bass. And it's nice to hear those big booming low voices on stage.
Yes, I love bass voices. And in those days, they were always relegated to bad kings or old guys or angry fathers. You know, they were never the heroes.
Are they ever the heroes?
Well, now you ask that question, Mary Shaw.
We ask that every year. I think there should be lots of bass and baritone heroes. That's my humble opinion.
Well, I can tell you of one man, an incredible bass, who I've just heard recently, who is the the star of any show he's in. It's Ferruccio Furlanetto, who I just saw in the spring sing the role of Thomas Becket in Murder in the Cathedral, which is an opera based exactly on the T.S. Eliot play. He's center stage for the entire thing. It's about his internal thinking of why he comes back and why he stands up for the church and God and not for the king and how he's murdered. The man is extraordinary. That bass voice is quite wonderful. And at the same time, when he finished singing that, he went straight to the Met to sing Don Carlo. And he is the king, King Philip, who arguably is probably the central character. Certainly when he is singing, he's the central character for me, with a really beautiful sound. And there's many roles now. Bass baritones can sometimes be bass singers. Don Giovanni can be sung by a bass baritone. But it's a wonderful sound. And Samuel Raimi, who we just heard, was one of the greatest. He's not singing to the extent he was. He had a magnificent career. But, I agree. Bass voices are wonderful. So you get the full spectrum in this opera, actually, from the bass to the mezzo-soprano, the high voices, and the battling tenors. There's even in one trio that Joyce DiDonato described as the Battle of the High Seas, where the two tenors are battling it out together. And guess who wins? Uberto wins because he manages to get in a high D. and there's all these wonderful things that go in as one-upmanship, which happens in opera. So, but actually, and the next little piece I'd like to play is not a high C section, I don't think. It's a recitative. Now, these are the little conversational bits where people sing to one another, but it's more of a conversational style, and the purpose is to move the story along. The arias are the sections where they sing about how they're feeling. And here it's where Douglas greets Rodrigo, who's come, the conquering hero, and they greet one another, how happy they are to see one another, and Rodrigo says, "Where is your daughter Ellen? I can't wait to see her." And the father's sort of covering for her, saying, "Well, she's coming." But in the course of this trio, all three of them come to realize something is not right. Rodrigo realizes she doesn't love him. She's trying to wonder how she getting out of it, and Douglas is simply angry. So I just want to play you a little of the recitative to get a sense of that conversational dialogue in this opera.
Al fin mi hai dato prenge, stringerti al seno, ma di sì grato istante, bramosa l'alma mia più dell'usato. Le ali al tempo agitò.
E qual desio fu adelante il mio cor.
Venga e ne offenda or Giacomo se il può. Rodrigo in campo seco e vittoria. Eventi più felici brillano già da così lieti aspici.
Se il saggio tuo consiglio il mio braccio avvalora, non dubitar, salva la patria allora.
Il presagio felice.
And so that's the recitative from, or one of them from, La Donna del Lago. And I mean, just so that word, it's spelled recitative. So
yes, it is, yes.
Where they recite to each other, really. And it's, I remember studying St. John's Passion by Johann Sebastian Bach in college, and there were a ton of these things, and they're musically pretty uninteresting, and then the wonderful musical bit comes after that.
That's right.
So it's like, this is what moves you along to tell the story. And then at some point in history, the opera became integrated, where instead of being recitatives and arias, it was all one big, huge opera.
Right. Originally, they were accompanied, these recitatives, just by single chords on a harpsichord, basso continuo, just to keep it moving along. But then gradually, different composers did instrumentation for these sections. And then they stopped doing the long arias with the repeat. So it was made much more sense for the whole piece to flow from beginning to end instead of going into these very cut-and-dried sections.
And that's when it really became true theater, if you can think of it as
theater. Yes, 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 opera drama, yeah, which culminated, of course, in Wagner. But Verdi was doing this beforehand, too. I mean, a number of them were. They were moving in that direction. It's a fascinating evolutionary process, how you get from Handel to Rossini to Verdi to Wagner. You know, it's a fascinating process. So now I'm going to play a piece by the chorus. In those days, they had bards, wonderful singers who would go from court to court or who were part of the clan. And in this case, the bards are the rallying chorus. We'll hear a lovely section that's introduced by a harp. There's a lot of harp and horns in this opera that gives a real sense of the time and period. And the purpose of this rallying chorus is that Rodrigo is going to war with the king, and there was a wonderful ceremony of the fiery cross in those days. This is based on truth, where there would be a ritual slaying, sacrificing of an animal, and then they would dip a cross in the blood of the animal, set it alight, and take it to the little hamlets in the various glens in the hills as a call for the men to come and fight with their chieftain. And they virtually had to do it. If they didn't do it, they'd die anyway. But it was a way of bringing the troops together, so to speak, to go to battle. In the opera, there's a sense of that in this chorus, but there's also a sense of another tradition where the leader would bang on his shield three times to rally the troops, another ancient Celtic tradition. All of this feeds into this opera, which we don't have to understand, but we do know that there is a gathering of the troops in this in order to get the people to go to war. There's also a meteor. Apparently, Scotland occasionally has meteors, a prophetic light in the sky, and the bards sing, "Behold, already a prophetic light of rare splendor shows the way to glory and honor." So this is the chorus of the Fiery Cross. And listen for the beautiful harp introduction.
Beautiful ensemble piece.
It is. It's very hard to ever find Rossini in a totally aggressive mood, even if he's writing a rallying cry to war. It's a very beautiful piece, this. The music is absolutely gorgeous, including especially this last aria that we will get to. Anyway, the troops all go
off. I have to say, a rallying cry to war that starts with harps.
Yes, exactly. Well, you know, whatever it takes. So the plot gets a little involved at this point. Rodrigo and Uberto get into a fight together because Rodrigo thinks Uberto is the other man and he has no idea it's the king, and they have a duel and Rodrigo does die off stage. We don't see it. His is the only death. And it looks as if the Highlanders of Douglas of Angus are losing the battle, so he goes off to Stirling Castle to ask for mercy from the king. And Elena goes in hot pursuit of her father because she realizes that the whole thing is falling apart. And she has been given a ring by Uberto, who, when he left her, he said, if you ever need help, bring this ring to the king's castle and you will be helped. So she goes off to the castle, and the final scene is set in Stirling Castle, where she asks for Uberto, who is singing off stage this wonderful aria about how he loves her. That was something Verdi picked up later with his some of his tenors, his romantic leads, would sing off stage before coming on. That happens here. It's very effective. So she goes to him and she says, we're in trouble. I have the ring and can you help? And he says, yes, come with me. And they open the doors to the throne room and everybody bows to the king. And she realizes it. She says, oh my God, you're the king.
So. But it doesn't make her love him.
No, she doesn't love him at all. No, she still loves Malcolm. So he says, what do you desire? And she says, my father. So the father's brought in chained and released, and then she says, Malcolm. And Malcolm is also brought in, and the king says, I don't think I can forgive him. He's been pretty fierce. And then takes a gold chain off his neck, puts it on Malcolm's neck, joins their hands together, and the opera has this blissfully happy ending that culminates in this extraordinary aria, Tanti Affetti, which brings the whole thing together, where Elena is center stage. The king is now the king in his rightful place. Malcolm is restored to her. Her father is safe. And the story ends happily ever after. So I'd love to play for you the Tanti Affetti. And the recording I have is actually with Joyce DiDonato, the incredible singer who will be singing our Elena this summer.
As well, and everybody marries the person they want to, and we all live happily ever
yes,
after.
Yes.
Which is why we go to the theater, because real life isn't like that.
Well, sometimes, but hanging on to it is difficult. So, yes, so hopefully everyone will come. It's an opera that's not been played very much in America. It's done a lot in Europe. In fact, Joyce DiDonato will sing it in June in London in a very contemporary version. Get on an airplane and come here and sing it in its traditional version, which is really nice, yeah.
La Donna del Lago.
The Lady of the Lake.
By Rossini. Desiree Mays, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Now, we're going to actually, before we go, talk about some other things that are happening. Like, opening night is the
28th of June, the Friday night.
28th of June, and it's the Grand Duchess of Charleston.
It is, at 8:30.
Okay. And there is not only a performance, but before that, tailgate parties in the parking lot, in the vast parking lot.
In the vast parking lot. This has become such a very special Santa Fe tradition that everybody can go and bring their car, their limousine, their truck, it doesn't matter, and have dinner in the car park. And this year, the company decided that they would have a competition. There will be prizes in different categories for original, fanciful, fabulous creations and best of show. Everyone will have their pictures taken, and it'll be great fun. It's the idea of the wife of the president of the opera's board of directors, actually. So in order to get into this, to find out about the categories and the prizes and celebrity judges and all of that, how to enter, you should go to Tailgate Tailgate Contest at SantaFeOpera.org. It's a lot of work. And you have to just fill in name, address, and contact how many people are in your group. So that's something to really go to town on this year. You can get really dressed up and bring your Waterford cut glass and a fabulous meal, and the judges will go around and choose who is the winner of the Tailgate Contest. So hopefully people would like to do that. There's something else, Mary Charlotte, coming up too this summer that's a second year now, that is a seminar actually on the opera campus. It's called Drama, Music, and the Meaning in Opera by music professor Mary Keim. And this runs for a week from 9:30 to 12:30 up at the opera. It's the week of July 30th to August the 3rd. It's a lovely package, actually. She will tell about the operas. There's a backstage tour. You tour the grounds, and you'll be part of the cantina, which is great fun during the day because that's where all the artists eat and meet and talk, and it's a fun place to be. Now, to find out about that, you need to call the opera at 946-2404. There's all sorts of ways of coming. If you're coming from out of town, there's a hotel involved. That's part of the package. Obviously, if you live here, you don't need the hotel. So it's called the Santa Fe Opera Seminar, Drama, Music, and Meaning in Opera by Mary Keim, and you can call the opera to find out about that.
Desiree Mays, again, thank you so much for being with us here on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
We've been talking to Desiree Mays, international opera lecturer and storyteller and author of the book Opera Unveiled. She speaks every night at the Preview Buffet at the Opera. The Santa Fe Opera is on the web at santafeopera.org, and the phone number is 800-280-4654, and the local number is 505-986-5900.